Welcome to the West Virginia Humanities Council's Sesquicentennial Speakers Bureau. This program features Joe Geiger, director of the West Virginia State Archives. On September 18, 2012, he spoke on the 35th Star West Virginia Statehood at the Alpine Theater in Ripley.
Our guest speaker this evening was a professor of history at Marshall University. He authored a book on the Civil War in Cabell County and is the current director of the West Virginia Archives and History. And now, the 35th Star West Virginia Statehood, we welcome Mr. Joe Geiger.
Thank you very much, Mike, and thank you very much for coming out this evening to hear me ramble for a little bit about statehood. It's one of my favorite things to do. I'm certainly very appreciative to Main Street Ripley and to the Humanities Council for putting on this program, and I do want to my goal this evening is to present statehood to you in such a way that you'll understand the process. It's a very confusing process and daunting sometimes to follow all the characters and to follow it to its conclusion, but we're going to try to do that a little bit this evening. First of all, I'd like to mention just a few things that we do at Archives and History. Our primary goal, of course, is to preserve the history of West Virginia, and that may come in the form of diaries or letters or photographs or audiovisual materials, books, you name it. Anything documenting the history of West Virginia, we take in at the Archives and seek to preserve those for as long as there's a state of West Virginia. But we're also very concerned about making sure that those documents are available to you, the true owners of the history of West Virginia. So we do that in a lot of different ways. We're involved in History Bowl. We're involved in, which is an eighth grade history competition. We had two teams from Ripley last year, in fact. We're involved with the Veterans Memorial Database. If you've been to the Capitol Complex, you've seen that Veterans Memorial that honors 20th century West Virginians who died during 20th century periods of conflict. We're also involved in the Records Management and Preservation Board, which helps county officials to preserve and to manage their records. And we've been involved with Bruce DeWeese and Jeff Waybright here in Jackson County. So we do a lot of different things. The highway historical markers, if you've seen those alongside the road, documenting West Virginia history, we're involved with those as well. But in terms of in making those documents available to you, the website has really changed everything in being able to put primary source documents on the internet. And we have, I think I've got, that is the first slide here. Yes. This is an online exhibit that we have on the statehood process. Tonight I'm going to tell you, try to give you a shortcut as to how West Virginia was created. But if you want to read the words of the gentleman who actually created the state of West Virginia, you can come here and do just that all the way through the statehood process. I also want to mention that I just came out with a book this year on the Battle of Allegheny Mountain, and I'm starting work on another project involving guerrilla warfare. We've done a number of things in line with the sesquicentennial. We put up a timeline that has a lot of links to newspaper articles, different things relating to either the Civil War or to statehood. But we've also scanned and put online probably about 2,000 Union militia letters. These are Civil War letters that are written by and about Union activities here in Jackson County. We have more than 100 of those online that you can actually view. And actually, as I was doing the guerrilla warfare thing, I was transcribing the Jackson County, and I came up with 24 pages single space. So a lot of those Jackson County letters are rich with history, you know, talking about bushwhackers and horse thieves and things like this. Jackson County, a very badly divided county, of course, during the Civil War. But I'm here primarily to talk about the creation of West Virginia. And, of course, to do that, you really start off by looking at some of the differences between Eastern and Western Virginia prior to the Civil War. Now, there are four major differences that I emphasize for my Marshall students who are required to do a long essay. You will not be required to take an examination, I promise. Nonetheless, hopefully you'll pick up something this evening. Even if you know the process, you'll pick up some things along the way that will be useful to you. I don't expect you to learn it all, but when somebody starts talking about some aspect of slavery, then you're able to counter that. And as we get started here, very important that we're going to dispel some myths along the way about West Virginia statehood and about the views of West Virginians. A lot of times in those early history books, we'll see that there were 32,000 Union soldiers and 7,000 Confederate soldiers. We've seen through detailed studies that there were at least 18,000 Confederate soldiers from present-day West Virginia. There are a lot more Confederates than historians have previously given credit for. Another thing that we'll dispel is in terms of Union sentiment. When we talk about the Ordinance of Secession, we'll talk about figures thrown out by historians that are something like 11-1. People in present-day West Virginia voted against the Ordinance of Secession. Probably the most detailed study was done by a man by the name of Richard Curry, A House Divided, and his figures come out to something more like 34,000 to 19,000. Yes, the majority of people here in present-day West Virginia did oppose the Ordinance of Secession, but there were a lot of people who did support it. And finally, we'll talk about slavery, and we'll dispel a lot of the myths. You know, some of those early historians, again, saying that the reason that West Virginia broke away from East Virginia was because of slavery, because we here in Western Virginia believe that this was a horrible crime that should be ended. As we'll see, West Virginians do oppose slavery, but it's not because of moral reasons. And that's very important when we talk about that statehood process. So when we talk about those issues, of course, slavery is one that is very important. Only about 4% of Virginia's slaves were in present-day West Virginia. So slavery wasn't nearly as prominent here in Western Virginia as it was in Eastern Virginia. And certainly Westerners had reasons to oppose slavery because of economic reasons. They opposed slavery, and you see different things. But when the John Brown raid happens, for example, you don't see Western Virginians rising up to support John Brown. They think that it's a crime against Virginia as well. So very important to note that slavery issue, and we'll talk about that again as we move forward. A couple of other issues that were related to the domination of the legislature by Eastern Virginians. And this is very important to note, and we'll look at political rights and representation in just a second. But very important to note that the legislature in Virginia was dominated by Eastern Virginians. And a lot of the decisions that they made, Westerners believed were unfair to them. One of these had to do with transportation. Certainly, West Virginians didn't believe that they got enough funding for transportation in Western Virginia. We only had those three turnpikes. We had part of the National Road. In terms of railroads, we only had the B&O Railroad at the time of the Civil War and a little branch line of that. So certainly this was a big issue for Western Virginians. Another issue that was of importance, certainly, was education. Western Virginians believed that as illiteracy was increasing in Western Virginia, that economic conditions were going to worsen. So it was very important to provide all children a free elementary education. And Eastern Virginians, again, didn't believe that it was the state's responsibility to pay for this. And they were like a lot of Southern states in this. But the point being that Westerners certainly were upset over the fact that they didn't get funding for either education or for internal improvements such as roads and things like this. And finally, the last issue, and probably the biggest issue between Eastern and Western Virginia, had to do with voting rights and representation. Very important to note that, of course, when Virginia was established as a state, when that first constitution was written in 1776, there weren't a lot of counties in present-day West Virginia. So it's natural that the legislature, the way that it was set up, would be dominated by Eastern Virginians. I think there were 20 senators from Eastern Virginia, 4 senators from Western Virginia. In terms of the House of Delegates, there were 2 per county. So obviously not as much representation in Western Virginia. But as time goes on, as you go through the decades, You see population in Western Virginia. And by Western Virginia, when we talk about this east-west sectional strife, we're talking about everything west of the Blue Ridge Mountains. So when we talk about Western Virginia, we're talking about areas that do not become a part of West Virginia. Okay, very important to note. So Western Virginians, they certainly were bothered by a few things in this Constitution in addition to the representation. A couple of these had to do with the fact that only white males who owned land could vote. You had to own land in order to vote. If you owned land in more than one county, you could vote in more than one county. This bothered Western Virginians. Another issue for them was that, I'm drawing a blank. The fact that they were not, you know, they might elect who their delegates were, their senators, but most officials were appointed rather than elected. Most officials, your sheriff, your county court, your governor, these were appointed by the Eastern-dominated legislature. So again, these are a couple of issues that Westerners had problems with. They went through a couple of other constitutions. That 1851 Constitution gives Western Virginians a lot of what they want, pretty much everything that they want. So this decade from the 1951 through 1861 is a decade of reconciliation between Eastern and Western Virginia. I think things were closer between East and West than they had been at any other time. But of course we know what comes. And it all starts with that election of 1860. Now we know who wins this election. We know how this plays out. We actually have four candidates in this. The Constitutional Union Party fields a man by the name of John Bell, who's seen as a moderate candidate. The Democratic Party actually splits, and they will field two candidates. The vice president, a guy by the name of John Breckinridge, will be the Southern Democrat candidate. And then the Northern Democrats are represented by Stephen Douglas. So we have these three candidates, and then we have this big tall guy that you recognize as Abraham Lincoln. And the South had made it clear that Lincoln's election was going to cause some big problems. And it wasn't necessarily with Lincoln himself, it was with the Republican Party and what they stood for. And what they stood for, one of the planks in their platform, if you will, was a non-extension of slavery. A non-extension of slavery. Again, they're not saying we want slavery abolished tomorrow, but they're calling for a non-extension. What that means, of course, is that we have all this territory out in the western United States. It's eventually going to be broken up into states. What the Republicans say is that no longer will we bring in slave states. And this has been the way that this country has kept together, really, for the first half of the 19th century. You continually had compromises reached where you brought in this state as a free state, this state as a slave state, to maintain that balance so that the thing that the South most feared, the outlawing of slavery through legislation, would occur. So anyway, as we know, Lincoln is elected, and as expected, you have seven states that leave the Union. They secede from the Union and form the Confederate States of America. And this happens at the end of 1860. And really, all eyes will turn to those border states, and in particular, Virginia. Of course, we fielded a lot of those early presidents. You think about our geography, our relation to Washington, D.C., so certainly a lot of people were concerned about what Virginia would do. Our governor at the time was a man by the name of John Letcher. John Letcher. And Letcher called for a special session of the legislature, but when they meet, they decide that instead they want to hold a special convention. And this convention will call it the Richmond Convention. It's been called the Secession Convention. Anyway, delegates are elected from around the state. 152 delegates gather in Richmond on February 13th to begin deliberations as to what Virginia will do in this crisis. And what we find is that you have some folks, particularly from Western Virginia, who say that, you know, we cannot secede. We have to stay a part of the United States. You have others, particularly from Eastern Virginia, who say, let's break away and let's break away now. But the vast majority of the delegates, at least at first at this Richmond Convention, are moderate in nature. They are moderate in nature. It's actually going to be a couple of events that occur outside the convention that determine what Virginia will do. And these occur almost 2 months after the convention, after the delegates get together. The first of these, of course, is the firing on Fort Sumter in Charleston Harbor that initiates the war on April the 12th. And then 3 days later, President Lincoln issues a call for 75,000 troops to put down the rebellion. And it's these two actions that will lead Virginia delegates to take a vote on April the 17th. And on April the 17th, they pass what is known as an ordinance of secession, basically severing ties with the United States. But it's not going to be official yet. This is a vote by the delegates, but it has to be confirmed by the people. This will be put to a statewide vote before it becomes official. Very important to note, though, that Virginia authorities will proceed as if it's a done deal. You know, they're going to go ahead and start allying with the Confederacy, seizing military installations. They're proceeding as if it's a done deal. You can see Jackson County was represented by Franklin P. Turner. And unlike a lot of delegates from present-day West Virginia, Mr. Turner voted in favor of the Ordinance of Secession. He favored the Ordinance of Secession. Anyway, as soon as that vote is taken, you have a number of delegates from Western Virginia who immediately withdraw from the convention and start heading back to Western Virginia. You know, we have to come up with some kind of plan to show that we disagree with this action that's been taken. So actually, within 5 days, and some people, this is our good friend Big John Carlisle. We'll talk about him quite a bit this evening. John Carlisle was an attorney from Harrison County, from Clarksburg. He'd been a congressman, and he had been a delegate at that Richmond convention and very outspoken against secession. And as a result, his life was threatened on numerous occasions. You actually had mobs that were gathering outside his hotel room. Some people believe that on his way back to Western Virginia, he actually stopped in Washington and informed Lincoln of what had happened. We're not sure about that. Anyway, we do know that Carlisle comes back to Western Virginia, to his hometown of Clarksburg, and on April the 22nd, only 5 days after that vote has been taken, on April 22nd, 1,200 Union supporters gather in Clarksburg to try to plan some kind of action. And what they determined to do is call for a larger convention to be held in Wheeling. And these meetings are great. You know, we didn't have MTV back then. We didn't have pro football. These meetings where people would get together and people would stand up and speak their mind, and then the proceedings would be published in the paper. These are something that are missing in today's society, I believe. But you have these taking place throughout present-day West Virginia. Very important to note that you have meetings taking place in favor of the Union, and certainly meetings taking place in favor of the Confederacy as well. So these, you know, it's great to read newspapers from this time and to see those meetings. Actually, there are one or two right here in Jackson County. They talk about one. It was the one that was documented in the newspaper, and I think it was the Wheeling paper, talked about a pro-secession meeting being held here. But in that, they're the people who are meeting are talking about a previous meeting that had been held by Union people and was dogging them. So you know that both sides were represented in this county. Anyway, as I said, at this convention, they call for a larger convention to be held in Wheeling on May the 13th. And we actually have 430 delegates that will show up here, but it's important to note how these guys came into their jobs, so to speak. And this is one of the issues that people raise about the constitutionality of West Virginia's creation. Some of these delegates were elected. You know, a group in a particular county got together and elected somebody to represent them. Some of them might have been handpicked at the courthouse. Some of them said, I have a few vacation days. I think I'll go be a delegate. So in other words, we have some of these delegates that are selected in an irregular manner. And yet they're participating in these steps that eventually will lead to the creation of a new state. One of the big issues that comes instantly is that our good friend Big John Carlisle calls for the formation of a new state on May the 14th. They actually draw an outline of it in the New York Herald, I think, on the following day. But Carlisle is calling for the creation of a new state called New Virginia. But most of the delegates there believe that he's ahead of his time, particularly since it's not even official yet. The voters have not even confirmed what their delegates have done. So what they decide to do at this first Wheeling convention, and they only met for 3 days, they adjourn on the 15th, they determine, well, if this we want to go back and we want to rally people against secession. We want to get them to vote against the ordinance of secession. However, if it passes, then we'll get back together in Wheeling. We'll elect delegates. We'll get back together in Wheeling and determine what we're going to do next. So that vote is going to take place on May the 23rd. And this is the ratification of the ordinance of secession. Now, what we see here, and you can see the numbers for Jackson County, and I think that these are approximates by Curry. And again, Curry, a lot of times you just don't have the figures to go from. So he does some conjecturing, certainly, but it's probably as good a guess as you're going to get in terms of how things went. He approximates that Jackson County voted against the ordinance of secession, but obviously you see a lot of numbers in favor of it as well. What's important to us is that Governor Letcher reports that Virginia, that it's official, that the voters of Virginia have approved this ordinance of secession. And you can see the figures up here that he reported. And certainly Westerners got a little upset when they saw these numbers. They said, you've got to be kidding. Again, what we see repeated by historians over the years with no foundation is 44,000 West Virginians voted against the ordinance, only 4,000 voted in favor. We have no idea where these historians got these numbers, but I think that subsequent events show that this couldn't be the case, that certainly the vote on the ordinance of secession would have been a lot closer than historians have previously put forth. Anyway, it is now official. Virginia has left the Union. So the question is, you have a lot of people in northwestern Virginia in particular who are unhappy. They don't want to leave the Union. They want to remain a part of the United States of America. Now, what do we do? How do we proceed in doing that? At this second Wheeling Convention, we call this the first session of the second Wheeling Convention, it runs from June 11th through the 25th, and we have 88 delegates who gather here. You still have probably a third of the counties that become West Virginia who don't have representation here. Nonetheless, these delegates get together. Carlisle again is jumping up and saying, let's create a new state. You still have people holding him back. Certainly a little bit more sentiment, I think, for statehood at this point, but the majority are still not ready. And what they determine to do is genius in the end, but it's going to be a different path. And that is, they decide to create, and this is the important part of this whole process, they create a union government for Virginia, okay? What they say, and Carlisle writes the document that kind of reiterates the facts here, is that our officers, our governor, our delegates, all those people who represent us as the political officials of Virginia, they have vacated their offices. What they've done is illegal. They've left their offices. They've left them open. What we're going to do is fill them. We're going to create a union government for Virginia. Again, they're not talking about being the government of northwestern Virginia or of western Virginia. They are talking about becoming the government for all of Virginia. And indeed, the Congress and the President of the United States will recognize them as such. They will become the government of Virginia. We call them the RGov. I always tell my students to call them the RGov. I've heard them called the Reorganized Government of Virginia, the Restored Government of Virginia, Reformed Government of Virginia. We'll just remember them as the RGov. And this is the crucial step in this whole process, is the creation of this RGov. So they do a number of things. There we see our Speaker of the House, Daniel Frost from Jackson County. And the governor, and our governor of Virginia again, was a man by the name of Francis Pierpont, who was an attorney. He wasn't a politician by any means, but he becomes the governor of Virginia. And he calls the legislature into session on July 1st. Unfortunately, we don't have enough people there to constitute a quorum, so they actually have to go home and try again the next day. But they began proceeding as the government of Virginia, as the House of Delegates, as the Senate for the state of Virginia. And so they will proceed as such. In fact, you know, we'll go ahead and talk about them just a second here because they're going to go away. The R-Gov, even after West Virginia is created, the R-Gov continues to function as the government of Virginia. In fact, after West Virginia is created, after Wheeling becomes the capital of West Virginia, the R-Gov offices, which have been in Wheeling, are moved to Alexandria, Virginia. And from there, they will continue to function as the government of Virginia, even after the Civil War concludes. Anyway, August the 6th, the Second Wheeling Convention reconvenes. They will meet from the 6th through the 21st. And by now, you have enough support for statehood. You have a committee that reports a bill that calls for the creation of a new state of 39 counties. Anybody know what this new state was to be called?
Vandalia.
Good guess?
Kanawha.
It actually was. All of these are ones that certainly are going to be considered along the way, but our first name was Kanawha. Actually, this is what was reported from the committee, and this is what's going to go to the voters of West Virginia when they seek to decide whether or not there will be a new state. And this they are going to do on October the 24th of 1861. All this is happening in 1861. Anyway, so this is put to the voters, essentially the question, you know, do you want this new state of Kanawha, and also elect delegates to a constitutional convention in the event that this passes. So it was kind of misleading to begin with. Anyway, you have to figure, given everything that I've told you this evening about sentiment in present-day West Virginia, that it would be a close vote. Certainly it was not. And that's another reason that people question our legality, is the lopsidedness of these vote totals. This particular one, 18,408 were in favor of a new state of Kanawha, and 781 opposed. And very important to note, if you break down the no's, if you break down where people actually vote against this new state, a lot of them come from the northern panhandle. A lot of them come from areas that are overwhelmingly Union. So what's the deal? Well, I really believe that these people felt safely in voting the way they voted, you know, in a lot of areas. And how did you vote? You didn't go into your secret little room and pull your curtain and do your little touchpad screen. No, you walked up to a table where Union men were undoubtedly holding this election, and you might have some Union soldiers lolling about, and you walked up to a table and you said, yes, I am in favor of this new state, or no, I'm opposed to this new state. And it was dangerous business. You know, we talk about the Civil War, and certainly, you know, I always think about the Civil War as Grant and Lee and this kind of thing. The real Civil War was fought in places like Jackson County, where someone who had been your neighbor for 30 years or someone who had been your best friend since childhood suddenly was on the other side of the war effort, suddenly was coming over to burn your house or haul you away to prison. You know, that was really the Civil War, as you think about it, in present-day West Virginia, and particularly in places like Jackson County. Anyway, it is now official, 18408 to 781. We do have that new state of Kanawha. So now what we have to do is write a constitution. And that just shows you some of the representatives. Andrew Fletcher is a prominent name. We see Daniel Frost, of course. And this is, I love this. If I can get back here where I can see it. If we expect to raise anything in our section, we have to work our crops. And I have been exceedingly annoyed in May by our candidates visiting us. He didn't like the political candidates coming by when he was trying to farm. I thought that was a real hoot. So he wanted to set it at a different time. Anyway, Constitutional Convention. This Constitutional Convention will convene on November the 26th of 1861 and will go on for several months. And that is the task that they're given. You have between 50 and 60 delegates at this Constitutional Convention. And really, the big three we put up there on the board. and we'll talk about something else as well. Naming of the state. We know we didn't end up with Kanawha, so what happens? Well, they begin a debate one day, and Kanawha gets tossed. And it's great to look through all the reasons, and you can imagine some of the reasons yourself why Kanawha gets tossed. Some people said, well, we already have two rivers, we have a county. Some people said it could be confusing. You know, Charleston this time was known as Kanawha Courthouse a lot of times. So you can imagine writing a letter to your girlfriend and addressing it to Kanawha Courthouse, comma, Kanawha County, comma, state of Kanawha. So it could get a little confusing. I love some of the politicians who cut right to the chase and say it's too hard to spell and too hard to pronounce. And I can tell you from working at the state archives, if I get a call from someone asking about Kanawha County or something along those lines, I know they're probably not from West Virginia. And yet if you look at that word, you can imagine how it would be difficult to pronounce if you didn't know that already. Anyway, so Kanawha gets tossed, and really the interesting thing comes when they begin debating over whether or not to include Virginia as part of the name. You know, you have a lot of people who say these people from Eastern Virginia have been treating us poorly for many, many years. We don't want to have anything to do with that. And you had other people who said it's not our fault that they're bad people. It's not our fault the Confederates did what they did. We've always been Virginians, and we deserve and want to have that as a part of our name. So in the end, of course, you know, we end up with West Virginia. So that's one that gets settled in one day. And actually, as I said on our website, I extracted that part of the Constitutional Convention debate just on the creation of the name. So you can actually go in and read, you know, word for word what they're saying about it. Boundaries, you have a lot of additional proposals. I think there were 32 counties that were considered to be added to this. You know, a little confidence boosting, maybe even people within the Constitutional Convention who are trying to sabotage it. And you do have that along the way. But you have a lot of these counties that have large numbers of slaves, or they are largely Confederate in sympathy. And we'd already taken in a lot of those counties already. So these get dropped. Essentially, we end up with the boundaries that we have today. Some of the states or some of the counties would have the opportunity to vote for that first chance that they got. But essentially, we end up with the boundaries that we have today. And slavery. This was the big one. And this is the one where, you know, the convention almost is pulled apart. You do have a few folks in here who are abolitionists. What I find really interesting about this convention is the makeup. You know, you think about your political figures. Somebody, if we were holding a constitutional convention today, who would probably, what would be their occupation? You'd think of a lot about attorneys or businessmen or this kind of thing. Our constitutional convention, the delegates who make up the constitutional convention, a lot of them were farmers. A lot of them were ministers, I thought was really interesting. So you have kind of a different mix, kind of a different makeup for this particular group of men who are writing this constitution for this new state. Gordon Battelle, this guy up here, he's a Methodist minister. He was an abolitionist, and he did try to insert gradual emancipation into the state constitution. This was a goal. You know, he brought it up several times, but almost instantly, you see the conversation change. You see somebody moving it to a different topic. They did not want to deal with slavery, and yet they were going to have to deal with slavery before it was going to get through Washington, because we have a changing landscape there in relation to, you know, the significance of the Civil War. Anyway, what we end up with in our Constitution, when it is approved by the members, when it's later approved by the people of West Virginia, is that no slaves or no free persons of color will be permitted into West Virginia. Now, that doesn't sound like a good abolitionist state, like a lot of those historians have led us to believe. If you're not allowing African Americans in your state, that doesn't sound like a good abolitionist state. Anyway, that's what our Constitution said, but this is going to have to be changed, obviously, before it's going to get through Washington. In any event, it is approved here, and it's approved by the voters, again, overwhelmingly, 18,000 plus to 500 plus. And then comes the key to this whole statehood process. Now, the U.S. Constitution says that in order for a new state to be created from an existing state, the existing state has to give its permission. So you can plug in the names here. That means that if West Virginia is going to be created from Virginia, then Virginia has to give permission for them to break away. Well, we're in the midst of the Civil War. We know how those folks feel in Richmond. We're going to hop in a stagecoach and take a road trip to Richmond. We've got another way, don't we? What do we have? That R-Gov. You remember that R-Gov? They're the government of Virginia. They've been recognized as such by the federal government, and they are operating as the government of Virginia. So they can give that permission that is necessary to meet that constitutional provision. And this is, again, the key to the whole process right here, is them being able to give that permission. Then it goes to Congress. And here's where things get even more interesting. And it's just fascinating. Again, if you go through this step by step, at how many turns this thing could have been derailed. This whole statehood process could have run off the rails. There were so many times when it was that close to ending. And we think it's a done deal by the time it hits Washington because, you know, like a lot of bills, it gets referred to a committee. In this case, it gets referred to the Committee on Territories. And West Virginians are feeling pretty happy about this because John Carlisle, Big John Carlisle, is a member of that Committee on Territories. And he's given the task of writing that statehood bill. So we're feeling pretty confident. Well, when he emerges a month later, the people of West Virginia are shocked, to say the least. Carlisle has changed things in drastic ways. He's called for gradual emancipation. He's put this in there. He's called for the addition of 15 counties. He's called for an entirely new constitutional convention to be held. In other words, it becomes evident that John Carlisle, statehood's foremost advocate for over a year, is now trying to do everything he can to sabotage it, to make sure that it doesn't pass. Fortunately, we have this man over here, Waitman T. Willie, our other U.S. Senator from Virginia, who saves the day. He, along with a senator from Ohio, Benjamin Wade. But Willie comes up with a gradual emancipation amendment, because this is the key. Again, we come back to the Civil War. When the war began, you know, Lincoln said, if freeing all the slaves will end the war, I'll do that. If freeing some of the slaves will end the war, I'll do that. If freeing none of the slaves will end the war, I'll do that. In other words, he had as his paramount goal to end the war, to bring these states back into the Union. This was his goal. But as time goes on, you have people in the United States, particularly in Congress, who see this as more, who see this as an opportunity to end this abomination in our country of slavery. You know, here's an opportunity. You know, not just bringing these states back into the Union, but let's end slavery as a part of this Civil War as well. So as this happens, you know, they're increasingly putting pressure on Lincoln, maybe pushing him ahead of where he'd want to be at times. But they're, you know, very determined that West Virginia coming up with a statehood bill that says that no more African Americans are going to be let into our state, that's not going to fly. So something has to be done to address slavery in this statehood bill, or it's not going to get through. What Willie does is provides for gradual emancipation. It does not call for immediate emancipation, as Charles Sumner, another senator, wanted. And in fact, West Virginia will enter the United States as a slave state. Slavery will still be legal at the time that West Virginia comes into the Union. In any event, the Willie Amendment is going to be enough to get us through. It passes the U.S. Senate by a vote of 23-17. One of those no votes, of course, coming from our good friend Big John Carlisle. He votes against statehood. Anyway, it will go to Congress. It will go to the House of Representatives and not be passed there until December the 10th. It will pass by a vote of 96-55. So this thing comes into Lincoln's hands. And to me, this is another one of those interesting points in relation to statehood. He gets this statehood bill, and he's not at all pleased. Lincoln certainly has seen the R-Gov as a means, perhaps, to be used as a template for bringing other states back into the Union. Recognizing that this war is going to end at some point, we have to bring these states back into the Union. How do we do so? You know, maybe what we've done in Virginia will work. But when they come to him with a statehood bill, he has a little bit more of a problem. He sends the statehood bill to his cabinet to ask them two questions. Is it constitutional? By that, of course, West Virginia's statehood bill. Is it constitutional and is it expedient? And like all good cabinets, they came back split 3-3. So it was back into his lap. So Lincoln, in the end, as we know, will sign this. Actually, he's walking about on New Year's Eve. He's getting a great deal of pressure from West Virginia's leadership, from Argov leadership. A lot of congressmen coming to speak with him. And, you know, we know that he signs this. In fact, you know, one of the neat stories about this is that he tells one of the congressmen to come back the next day, and I'll show you a neat little trick. And he comes back the next day, and the White House is not yet opened, and somebody lets him in through a window. Now, can you imagine going to the White House today, showing up New Year's morning, and going in through a window? I think it's just fascinating. Lincoln met with him. Lincoln dragged him in there, pulled open the drawer, and there was the signed statehood bill. So, you know, I think Lincoln makes it very clear. And again, you can read these documents. You can read the argument by Seward, the Secretary of State, in favor of West Virginia's creation. You can read the documents by the Attorney General, Edward Bates, against it. And more importantly, you can read Lincoln's opinion. Very brief. You know, it's only a couple of paragraphs, his justification for doing what he does. But I think in the end, you know, he feels that he can't turn his back on the loyal people of West Virginia. You know, let's think about this for just a moment. You remember a guy by the name of John Brown, 1859. What happens to him? He gets hanged. What does he get hanged for? What's the charge? Do you remember?
Treason.
He was committing treason against the state of Virginia, and he was hanged in 1859. Now, what do you think about these people up in Wheeling who are creating the Argov, first of all, and later creating this new state of West Virginia? What crime are they committing if you're sitting down in Richmond? Treason. They're committing treason against the state of Virginia. So if it weren't for military troops protecting them, if Confederate troops could have gotten there, I guarantee you they would have been hanging from lampposts, because according to Virginia authorities in Richmond, they were committing treason. So I think this is was the key for Lincoln. He didn't feel that he could turn his back on loyal Union men. These are people who had put it all on the line to support the United States of America. And I think that Lincoln could not turn his back upon these loyal men and women of West Virginia. In any event, it has to go back to the Constitutional Convention. They'll meet again, and within a few days they unanimously pass the addition of the Willie Amendment to the Constitution, and then they strike out that part about no free African Americans can be permitted into the state. So they do these things, goes back to the people. You've got Carlisle going across the state trying to get people to vote against statehood, which seems kind of surreal, but it is approved overwhelmingly, 28,000 plus to 500 plus. And so once that happens, Lincoln issues his statehood proclamation on April the 20th, stating that in 60 days, West Virginia will become the 35th state, and that's indeed what happens. This actually is a sketch, a Dis-de-Bar sketch of Governor Arthur Borman at his inaugural. And we have the inaugural address online, and you can see a little quote there from his inaugural address. I would note one other thing, and I'm awfully sorry that I didn't bring it. I don't know where I misplaced it, but I printed off something. That timeline that I told you about, our sesquicentennial timeline, where we put articles and official reports, things like this relating to the Civil War or statehood, there's one from April, I want to say it's April the 6th, so it's like 3 days before Lee surrenders. There's a raid right here in Jackson Courthouse, as they called it at the time. They raided Andrew Flesher. They took some of his horses. They stole a bunch of horses, did a bunch of stuff. But as I said, you know, even as the war is ending, it's still dangerous business right here in Jackson County. In any event, just a couple of things to sum up what I've spoken about this evening and my beliefs. You know, most of this stuff that you heard is factual. Some stuff I throw out there is a belief. And for me, the big one is that I don't know how that West Virginia could have become a state at any other time. When you think about the fact that U.S. Constitution calls for the existing state to give its permission, I find it difficult to believe that Virginia would have at any time given its permission for Western Virginia to break away. And without that happening, West Virginia never exists. So I just find it difficult to believe that we could have happened without the Civil War. The Civil War, it ends that reconciliation between Eastern and Western Virginia. The Civil War gives us the R-Gov. You know, if you have no R-Gov, you'd have no West Virginia. And without the Civil War, you don't have any reason to have an R-Gov. Neither Lincoln nor Congress, I think they made very clear what we're doing in creating West Virginia is not something to be seen as a precedent for peacetime. In other words, we're doing something very extraordinary here. And I firmly believe that that was the case. And certainly that military protection is the key in making sure that this whole process can happen. Anyway, I've rambled, I think, probably about enough. I don't have a clock, so I don't know how long I've been rambling. But I'd be glad to take some questions, or if you have comments, the floor is yours.
Joe, could you talk about the financial arrangements between when West Virginia and Virginia are separated? How do they decide things like the hospital West and things like that? How do they decide how to settle up the financial end of it?
I'm not sure exactly how they did it, but I know they had committees, they had groups that got together and broke that down, and that was a process, of course, that would not end until 1939. Virginia does, in fact, have to sue West Virginia to recover the costs of various things. Let's say, for example, they had invested X number of dollars into Weston, and then West Virginia would pick up the tab for that kind of thing. So I'm not sure exactly how they broke it all down, but it was a very, very lengthy process that will not end until 1939 when West Virginia makes its final payment. Sorry, I don't know more specifics, Mike. Any other questions? Yes, Mark.
John Carlyle's story has always sort of been interesting. I'm just curious, do you have a theory, or have you or other historians done any research to figure out, did something happen, or what prompted him to sort of flip-flop like that?
That's a great question, and historians have pondered Carlyle all this time, and every time you think you've got him figured out, you say, well, no, that doesn't work here. Why? You know, you have people who say, well, he did it because he was opposed to that he was a pro-slavery guy. Well, then why in his proposal does he put gradual emancipation in there? Probably the best interpretation is by the same guy that gave us those Ordinance of Secession figures, Richard Curry. He did a nice little analysis of Carlyle, talking about him being a copperhead. Carlyle made it clear when they were in there with this lengthy debate, that, again, you can read all the U.S. Senate debate on July 14th of 1862 on there. I think Carlyle makes it clear that if West Virginia would be admitted the way that Constitution was written, that he was okay with it, that he would sign off on it. I think Carlyle was a strict constitutionalist. I think that he believed that Congress had the responsibility to sign off on West Virginia statehood or to vote it down, but they didn't have the right to go in and mess with the Constitution. They didn't have the right to go in and change things. Well, he's made those very same changes in his bill as he's coming out with it. Maybe he smelled the air and realized that, again, because of that growing power exerted by radical Republicans, that something was going to have to be done about slavery before this statehood bill was going to get through Congress. That's probably as good an explanation. You have others like him. Very important to understand as you go through this statehood process. Think about this. Obviously, we've got 20,000 Confederates from the beginning who are going to be opposed to West Virginia, right? Well, we have a lot of Union people. We have all those Union men who gather up at the first Wheeling Convention. You have some of them who say, well, when this becomes about creating the R-Gov, I'm out, okay? I'm still a Union man, but I don't support what you're doing in creating the R-Gov. Same kind of thing happens when you have West Virginia, when it becomes about creating the new state of West Virginia. You have people who support the Union, who have supported the R-Gov, but say no to West Virginia. No, you're overstepping your bounds here. So think about the opposition that these statehood makers faced. And that's certainly one of the reasons why they're going to be out of power in a hurry, is the fact that not only are they facing opposition from Confederates and Confederate supporters, but they're facing opposition from other unionists. You know, I don't think Carlisle was alone. I think there are other people who believe that Congress was overstepping its bounds in relation to, forcing an end to slavery, this kind of thing. I think he was bothered by that. That's about as good an explanation as I can offer, and it's the most logical. Thank you, Mark. Any other questions? Well, if not, I thank you very much. I really appreciate the opportunity to be with you. I love Ripley. I've been here as long as I can remember being alive, coming through. My mother used to make me stop at the Dairy Queen here because apparently they were the only place where she could get peanut butter milkshakes of some sort. DQ out there. But anyway, thank you very much.
Thank you for your interest in this program of the West Virginia Humanities Council. We invite you to learn more about council programs, grants, and membership by visiting our website at www.wvhumanities.org.